As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hey everybody, and welcome to another episode of Wings for Breakfast, our twice weekly Red Wings podcast here on The Athletic, presented by BetMGM. I am Max Boltman. With me, as always, is Prashant Iyer. The Red Wings had two games this past weekend against Tampa Bay Lightning. They win 1-0 in the shootout. Thomas Greiss gets his second straight shutout, and this time the Red Wings win it. And then in game two, they lose 2-1 against the Lightning. Philip Zadina scores, Jonathan Bernier posts 40 saves, but the Lightning win it 2-1. They have two more games left in their season, none of them this week. It'll be Friday and Saturday at Columbus, a game with very big draft lottery implications. We'll get to that in a second, but Prashant, any takeaways that you had out of these two games against the Lightning?
I mean, this has been absolutely brutal hockey. Like, we're talking about a team right now just missing basically the entirety of their offense, and you are seeing exactly that. I mean, the Wings have been grossly outshot in four of their last five games. I was looking through Evolving Hockey's stats, and it blew my mind that in four of the last five games, the Wings have been sub 30% in the 5-on-5 expected goals for percentage, and somehow have won, you know, more than one of those hockey games. So it's just like, whatever this defensive structure is, it is infuriating for teams to play against because it keeps them in hockey games. But man, oh man, there is absolutely no offense anywhere to be found.
No, there's not. I mean, the goal they score comes on an odd man rush and some nice back and forth with Zadina and Vladislav Namestnikov. Other than that, I mean, just not a lot going on. Jacob Vrana is still creating some. You know, Zadina has actually had a few opportunities in these last couple games, and that was the first one that he had got to go, which I guess is kind of how shooting percentages work, isn't it? But, you know, it's just not nearly enough. They're getting destroyed in shot attempts and shots on goal per game. And while I do think, you know, as we've talked about in the show before, the Red Wings are a little bit comfortable with that trade-off as long as the quality of chances ultimately skews even or in their favor, man, it makes for some high pressure situations in the D zone for almost the whole game for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's just basically they have collapsed into a defensive shell, and they are willing to just play this bend but don't break defense. I mean, you know, you alluded to the Zadina goal with him being able to go on that 2-on-1 rush. That only happens because Tampa had a 4-on-2 and yes. Bernier makes an outstanding stop right. That kicks that puck to go back the other way. It's literally like, hey, the goalies are playing really well right now. And that kind of, you know, leads me into Thomas Greiss, who's really found his game. But we're just going to rely on our goalies to bail us out night in and night out. We're going to try and keep as much as we can to the perimeter and hope it works. It's basically the pure definition of, you know, pulling the pin, lobbing the grenade up in the air, and then just closing your eyes and hoping it doesn't come down and hit you, because they are absolutely playing with fire. But because Grice and Bernier have been just sensational, really the better part of April, they've been able to stay in and win some of these hockey games that really they have no business being anywhere near.
But they've done it consistently, and that does make me wonder if there's not something to it, you know?
I mean, this is exactly, I think I said this maybe a handful of episodes back, the way the Wings play is exactly the kind of team you do not want to play in the playoffs. This is exactly the kind of team that capitalizes on variance. This is exactly what Tortorella did to Tampa, you know, a couple years ago in the playoffs. This is what we watched those past two games. That's what Tampa had to deal with. They floridly outplayed the Jackets in that series and they got swept. And so it's the same kind of deal where you basically come in, you outshoot Detroit by, you know, 40 shots combined over the two games, and you win 2-1 and you lose 1-0. Like, that's, it's just, they're not the fun team to play against at all, but it's really the only way they can go when you're missing your entire offense.
To me, the thing that I found the most objectionable about, you know, their play was, you know, as has been the case often this season, was the power play. It's just not nearly enough danger. The entries aren't good. They don't get set up well. They don't get dangerous looks, even when they have the odd man advantage. They had a 2-minute 5-on-3. I think they got one shot on goal. Did they get one? They got one shot on goal in that, right?
Yeah, I mean, just one shot. And it wasn't even that great of a shot.
Not good. I mean, and after the game, you know, so the situation is the Red Wings, when you practice the power play, you're practicing 5-on-4. You're probably not devoting a lot of time in practice to 5-on-3. It's just not a common enough situation, especially in a year where there's very little practice time, to spend much of your kind of limited on-ice hours repping 5-on-3, and yet you are 5-on-3. Like, that stands for every team in the league, and every team in the league mostly manages to have pretty good 5-on-3.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say most teams can do it, although, you know, you're right, Max, to your point about not practicing it. Tampa had a 5-on-3 in that game that they ended up losing in a shootout late in the third period after Sam Gagner.
But it was dangerous the whole time.
Dangerous in the sense that they had the puck the entire time. But the part that I was actually really struggling with that Tampa power play was they could not figure out what shot they wanted. Yeah. Actually, let me take that back. They knew exactly what shot they wanted, and that was the only shot they were willing to take. And Detroit was able to basically take that one shot away. And so while Tampa had the puck the whole time, and you feel that danger and that pressure, they weren't necessarily taking the best of shots, because the one single play that they wanted to go to, that slot pass, you know, from down low up high, yeah, they couldn't get it. And so that was, just kind of fascinating to watch as another example, because then Detroit comes in, and now granted, they don't have the puck nearly as much in threatening situations as Tampa did. Like, you know, in that Tampa 5-on-3, the puck was always in a dangerous situation. It just, they were trying to force this one specific shot and they couldn't necessarily get that to work, whereas Detroit can't even get the puck to be in a dangerous situation for a prolonged period of time. So, you know, just differences there, but it is kind of fun to see all of that and just realize that Detroit's got to be way better in that situation if they're going to try and win a hockey game like that.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, the power play at this point is, I got to refresh the stat, but it is right now, it's like the third worst of the decade. And I think it's bottom five since the NHL has kept track, which is like 1978. Bottom five power play percentage of the last 40 plus years at 10.3%. Like I don't know if you comment on a stat like that or if you just let it ride, but what comes to mind when you hear that?
I mean, we talked about it earlier in the season when they were on that 0-for-41 streak, right? When they were actually starting to come up on history with the longest goalless drought that at least I could track back through many, many hours of scraping NHL.com. And now you're seeing it come back around where their power play has again dropped back down to just 10%. It's just like, my God, like how do you fix this? And this is on the heels of already being the worst power play team last year. You know, I think a lot of people have been somewhat frustrated with the coaching. I thought you had a really nice piece talking about Blashill there. But really, the biggest issue that seems to need to be fixed for this team right now is that power play. Because, I mean, you can't run multiple years with a historically awful power play and seem to think that you're going to be able to win these kinds of hockey games that are defense first.
Yeah, I said it right. 10.3% is fifth worst since they started keeping track in 1977-78 in a single season. The worst ever is a tie between this year's Ducks. So they're not even the worst in the league technically this year. And the 97-98 Lightning, that is both at 9.4%. I don't think they can get there in two more games, barring something ridiculous. But that still tells you pretty much all you need to know about how bad it's been. As does the fact that at 10.3%, the 15th ranked power play, so pretty much squarely middle of the pack power play in the NHL. I guess 16 would technically be middle of the pack, but it works better for my stat if I say 15, is 20.6%, and the Buffalo Sabres, which is double. So if the Red Wings were twice as good on the power play, they'd still just be middle of the pack.
And that's the fun part, is now do the math where if you were to just give them a league average power play, how many more goals would they actually score based on the number of chances that they're generating? Because 15. That's the thing.
Right? I did this earlier today.
Yeah, yeah, I know. So it's like you add another 15 goals to this hockey team, the team that's already the worst scoring team in the league, and maybe you actually win a handful more of those games that, you know,
yeah,
you
depending on what games you get them.
Right, exactly. Like, depending on the games that you get them in, potentially you're looking at, two or three more wins? I think most people, you know, the mathematical conversion for goals to a win tends to be somewhere around 5.5 to 6. Depending on what you're looking at. So you're literally talking about, you know, there are 5 or 6 points left on the table right there that simply would just come from being league average at the power play. And so I think that's got to be the frustrating thing if you're the head coach of the Red Wings, if you're anyone watching this Red Wings team, is if you literally could be average at this one thing, you would have anywhere from 5 to 6 more points. Now, granted, that may not be the best of things for this hockey team based on what they need, but it's frustrating when it's something that simple. Just be average at the power play.
Yeah, be average at the power play, and really, if you're gonna play the way that they play at 5-on-5, it's a must. I mean, you if you're gonna have it all be about limit the easy stuff the other way on five on five, like then you have to do that and really have a power play that can make that work for you. You know, and you know, I don't like to call for people's jobs. You know, whenever it's a toss up or whatever, I don't tend to kind of go to that well early. I just, something has to change about the Red Wings power play. And I don't know how you can bring back Bylsma, at least in the power play capacity, if it's bottom five of the last 40 years. I mean, like, how do you run that back?
And that's the thing is, again, if you go back and you look at last season, they were already the worst power play last year in just about every metric. So this is a team that's now back-to-back years effectively been the worst team on the power play. And I don't even know anything that you can see there that really is like, yeah, there's signs of encouragement. I mean, whether it's simply goals that you're looking at, whether it's expected goals for, whether it's shots actually taken at the net, there's nothing redeeming about this power play that suggests that it should be better than it actually is. And I think that's where you've got to be most frustrated. Like, you know, certainly there's bounces that don't go your way. There's things that, you know, are out of your hand. A stick snaps on a grade A scoring chance. That stuff happens. But really, Detroit's not even generating those chances to deserve those goals. And so that's where I think you have to have a huge shakeup. If anything needs to happen from there, I think that's where the shakeup's got to be, because you can win the way Blashill is coaching. He has demonstrated that. You know, we've seen other teams demonstrate that, but you can't do it when your power play is going to be the worst in the league. And frankly, the penalty kill has been a lot better, but at one point, the penalty kill was also the worst in the league. And so you can't actually be a competitive hockey team in that regard if that's where you're going
to
be.
Yeah, I think the eternal question is going to come back to, is the talent there to make this power play? You know, do they have average level talent on the power play? And to me, I look at it and I say, you know, do they have league average NHL talent overall? I'd still probably put it below. I would not put it at half of the capacity of the middle team. Like that, I certainly would not say that. So, you know, if you want to say last year at 14.9% was a more reasonable expectation from, I think that's fair, like a reflection of their true talent. If you want to argue that variance is responsible for some of the dip this year, I listen to it, but I look at it and I say, you know, you've had now, whether it's Mantha or Verana, one of those two, you've had Larkin, you've had Zadina. You know, I think Filip Peronik, for as much as people want to criticize his power play, I still think he can be a power play weapon. Now, whether he's in the right spot on that power play is a different matter. We know earlier in the year the Red Wings wanted to try him on the flank, and obviously there just weren't enough power play QB options to, I guess, keep that up. I can't believe that there aren't, you know, that there's not enough talent overall on this team for the power play to make it at least, you know, not the worst of the last four decades or one of the five worst of the last four decades.
I mean, you want to be as simple and straightforward as possible with it. Max, who's that team you used at 15th?
Buffalo.
Buffalo. It's Buffalo.
Without the Jack Sabres. Eichel.
Right. They don't have Jack Eichel and they traded away Taylor Hall. Like, and they traded away Eric Staal. Like, that is Buffalo. They're the league average team. Like, so Buffalo can do it. You can do it. Like, I don't know what the problem is, but I just, that makes the point right there that Buffalo can have a league average power play at 20.6%. And the Red Wings are half of that right now. And it's just miserable.
Yeah. Yep. I agree. So anything else you want to talk about before we go to the mailbag? I guess we could talk about the lottery implications of this weekend. What should people be hoping for?
Well, I mean, if you're the realist and recognizing that the Wings definitely need some more shots at elite talent, you're hoping Columbus takes both of these in regulation and that you get a couple of other, help around the league. I mean, the Devils have certainly been doing their part. The Senators were almost doing their part until they blew that lead to Montreal. And then you need the Canucks to start winning some of these games in hand. But I think that's what you're looking for around the league to happen. But really, against Columbus, you got to find a way for them to come out with two or three more points than you. So Columbus somehow has to win both these games.
If you are someone who is of that mind and you would prefer that the Red Wings drop both and get and maximize their position in the lottery, ultimately what it takes is you need Columbus to win both. You need LA to win at least one more of their last seven games. You want Ottawa to win at least one more. You need the Red Wings to lose both in regulation. You need Ottawa to win one more game this year. You need Vancouver to win two more games this year and at least one in regulation. You need you need New Jersey to win two more games this year in regulation or overtime. That, I think, the maximum you're going to get to at this point with any kind of realism is third from the bottom, which would be the fourth best lottery odds. That's the path there. Columbus wins both games this weekend in regulation. LA wins one more game. Ottawa wins one more game. Vancouver wins two more games with at least one in regulation. Is that right? Or is it more than that in regulation? Is it two more in regulation for Vancouver?
I think it's two more in regulation for Vancouver, but they've got so many games in hand.
Yeah. Okay. And then New Jersey would need to win two more with at least one in regulation or at least one in regulation. Yeah.
Yeah. At least one in regulation. And really the easiest way to keep track of this for those of you that are very much invested in the Red Wings being able to pick in the top five, Micah McCurdy on his site HockeyViz has a chart titled the Sadness Chart, which is giving a team the probability of, or what's their likelihood of missing the playoffs and not picking in the top five. And so it factors in the lotteries. It factors in all of those, the likelihood of them winning their remaining games. So right now, as it stands, Columbus is at 66% likelihood of missing the playoffs and not picking in the top five. Detroit is also at 66%. New Jersey's at 57%. Ottawa's at 74%. Vancouver, LA, Chicago, and San Jose are all north of 80%. So really, you know, the teams that they're jostling with, I think, that are most important are going to be New Jersey, Ottawa, and Columbus. And so they have the ability there, you know, with Columbus. I mean, I saw someone tweet this. I can't remember who tweeted it. Might be time to give Caden Fulcher a look, right?
I guess there's that route too. Although that would provide a whole lot of fuel for the people who have been talking about the Red Wings tanking for the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, now that would be certainly far more blatant than you maybe want to be in that. And I don't think your players would respond super well to pulling Greiss and Bernier in favor of Caden Fulcher. But at the same time, if you want to make it happen, I think there's a route there, because really, truth be told, the Red Wings, the way they've played, haven't deserved to win any of their recent hockey games, save for that last Columbus game. And the only reason they have points in any of them is because of Greiss and Bernier, which was, again, the big concern when you signed Greiss at the beginning of the season was he going to make that goaltending tandem too good? For a large part of the season, he didn't have his game. But right now, this is vintage Thomas Greiss. I mean, for the month of April, Greiss led all goalies in goals saved above expected. When you factor in the quality of shots that he faced, he nearly doubled up second place. That's how good he was.
He was the NHL's first star of the week this week.
Exactly. So, you know, the Red Wings goalies, if you're looking for the ace in the hole, what you have to take away from the Red Wings is not every single offensive player. You have to take away their goalies.
Yes.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Victorinox, the makers of the original Swiss Army knife, have been a reliable companion for life's everyday challenges, mastering functionality, innovation, iconic design, and uncompromising quality with its products. The Victorinox Swiss Army knife provides you with all the things you don't think about until you need it. Tweezers, a screwdriver, and even a corkscrew. With the Victorinox Swiss Army Knife, you can be prepared to master everyday life. You can find Victorinox Swiss Army Knives at Dick's Sporting Goods.
All right, shall we go to the mailbag?
Let's do it.
All right, we got two to start off on Filip Hronek. The first one is pretty broad. Cody Stark, compare how you felt about Filip Hronek in October of 2019 to how you feel about him now. Has he exceeded expectations? Is he disappointed? Is he right where he should be? Compared to October 2019, Prashanth, where are you at on Filip Hronek?
I mean, so October 2019, you're coming off of Filip Hronek's really solid 18-19 campaign where he had some pretty good results. Granted, he was in a relatively sheltered role, but he looked really, really promising. And I think if you probably went back and tracked back my tweets, I was really excited about him. I thought, man, this guy is an absolute steal. You know, getting him 53rd overall in the 2016 draft, I think he was, I was very excited about him being this, outstanding hockey player because he was basically a half point per game defenseman as a rookie in 18-19. Looked good on the power play and the chances that he got, and there was certainly a lot of excitement there. I think obviously the big thing is, you know, with Nick Cronwall not being available, Danny DeKeyser missing a whole bunch of 2019-2020, you really saw Filip Hronek real quickly get ushered into you are now the guy, and he really struggled, I think, in 19-20, particularly as the season went on. I think you saw the number of minutes he was playing really wear on him. And then this season, again, you know, you were sort of hoping that with the additions of John Merrill and Troy Stetcher, a healthy Danny DeKeyser, that he would be able to maybe shed some of those minutes. He really hasn't. And his even strength scoring has sort of dropped off, although I think, you know, he's certainly rounded out his game a little bit better recently. So moral of the story, I think if I'm comparing my expectations back to October 2019, I'm disappointed about where he's at right now. If I compare him back to the fact that he's the 53rd draft pick, I am ecstatic with what you've actually gotten at 53rd.
Yeah, I think for me in 2019, coming off the end of that season, I was starting to notice Hronek's, you know, whether it's his underlying impact. I think we were on the Winged Wheel pod together at one time before this one existed, and we were talking about Filip Hronek and about kind of his impacts. I think we were looking at maybe Micah McCurdy's Hockey Viz chart at that time, and it was really promising, and we were saying, hey, you know, this is a guy that maybe should be getting a little more attention, and I think probably at that time I would have said this is a guy who, if development goes right, you know, I don't know if I would have said top pair or top four. Right now I think where I'm at is I think he's a second pair defenseman who can play really big minutes, which is exactly what he's doing, except for he's doing it as the top pair defenseman, as the number one defenseman for the Red Wings. So have I come down a little bit on him from 2 years ago? Probably, but not by a whole lot. And I think ultimately he's a really steady three or four for you. Obviously, if you're a contender, you'd prefer that be as a four. But if you're just a regular playoff team and he's your three, I think that's fine. I think he's proven that he's capable of playing a big role. I think he'd be better if he were playing 2 minutes less per game a night, which is about what you want out of your second pair defenseman. But I think he could play in every situation. I know people, again, are upset with him on the power play right now. And again, I think he's just in the wrong spot on the power play. I think he should be on the flank, and the Red Wings just don't have someone up top to make that feasible for them. Like, who are you replacing with Hronek up top? You've already got Chalowski in that spot on the other power play. So I guess if you're going to, you know, Prashant's probably would say keep Dennis Chalowski up top for the whole 2 minutes, keep one power play unit for 2 minutes, which I don't disagree with
or
necessarily.
Five forwards.
Yep. Although I still think you want a defenseman who's more comfortable walking the line. I have yet to see a forward look super comfortable walking the line up there, but I get it. But as long as they have two units, they just simply don't have another person. Like, I guess you could try to put Stetcher there. Stetcher does not have necessarily the shot from the point that I would say makes him ultimately that dangerous. You could try Mark Stahl. Don't think it looked very good with Danny DeKeyser. Like, I just think he should be on the other flank. But other than that, he kills penalties. He's a good even strength player, in my opinion. He can move the puck, he can pass the puck, he can shoot the puck, and I think he defends fine. I think he's a good second pair defenseman, which is probably a little lower than I was on him in 2019. But ultimately, like you said, still exceptional value for where they got him, and I think still very much a piece of this thing going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think just the biggest challenge I've had to deal with is how do I reconcile Filip Hronek with what I see on the ice, which appears to be a guy that you know, seems to make good moves, seems to have, you know, reasonable, you know, breakout passes, seems to be an okay skater, you know, all of those components. How do I reconcile that with his stats that do attempt to account for a lot of that context that, you know, mentally speaking, when we're watching live, we just simply cannot. And, you know, it's tough. That's the huge challenge for me, because when I look at his numbers, like, Max, do you know what percentile Filip Hronek is in from a goals above replacement standpoint this season?
I haven't looked in a while. It's probably not good. It's probably like 13th or something.
0.6. All right. I mean, it's literally, you're saying he's 99.4% of players have better goals above replacements than him. He's in the 0.6th percentile. And so, again, there's a lot of those contextual factors that I think sometimes these models don't have the ability to fully.
And goals above replacement is the most outcome based. We should know,
right?
Like, that's the one that's the most, like, you know, if you're on the ice for a goal against, you are getting hit for it, you know, more than you would for, say, in hockey versus heat maps or in GSVA, quite to the same degree, at least, right?
Yeah, that's correct, because goals above replacement from the Twins model on evolving hockey, that is based on the target variable of goals. You can always flip it over to the expected goals above replacement to get a little bit better assessment there. When you do that, you know, Filip Hronek definitely pans out a little bit better. He's actually still amongst the worst defensemen on his own team by that regard. But even still, it does look a little bit better because he's had the misfortune of being on the ice for a lot of goals against.
And he plays the toughest, you know, competition, certainly in his
role. And that's the thing where, like, you know, some of these models will tell you that they account for it, that they can do that. I think there is still some areas where maybe they don't fully account for it, even though it is included. But, you know, at the end of the day, whether you use goals above replacement and he's the 0.6 percentile, use expected goals above replacement and he's the 22.8 percentile, either way, there's still a long way off of, you know, the kind of defenseman I think a lot of people thought he would be after that 18-19 season, right or wrong at that time.
Yeah. All right. Well, that leads us into kind of the next question, which is from Jordan Harris, and he says, given Moritz Seider and the other right-handed D in the system, so I guess that would probably include Troy Stetcher, Gustav Lindstrom, Antti Tuomisto. Who am I forgetting?
I mean, I think those are the big ones, because McIsaac will be a lefty, Johansson will be a lefty.
Sabrango's a lefty.
Yeah, Sabrango's a lefty, so right. Those are probably the big ones.
So given those ones that we mentioned, where does Hronek fit in to the future, and is he more valuable as a trade piece than he may be at his highest due to his role?
I think
when his value may be at its highest due to his role.
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating question. And granted, I significantly paraphrase this because this was like three paragraphs in my DM. So, Jordan, you told me to paraphrase it. That was my attempt to paraphrase it. I think it's a fascinating question because this is one of the scenarios where perception doesn't line up with the stats, right? I think across the league, a lot of people talk about Filip Peronik as a top pairing defenseman because that's what he's doing right now. He's playing all of those minutes. And so does that inflate his value over his actual production? In which case, you know, if his actual production is going to be what it is, do you make that deal at that time, or do you make that deal now when you might be able to get more back because people are viewing him as a one or two defenseman because that's what he's been doing for the last 2 years? I don't know what you think, Max.
Well, it's tough. I mean, I think ultimately you have a good young right-handed defenseman that's a really valuable commodity for a reason, because they're hard to find. And because when you don't have one and you want one, it costs you a ton to get one. So usually when you have one, you try to hold on to them. Now, if you're the Red Wings and you say, hey, I have one of those on the way, I think, in Moritz Seider, and maybe I can get another one in like a Brant Clark in this coming draft, maybe I'm comfortable saying, hey, okay, that's fine. If I can, if other people feel like this is a valuable commodity, and I think it's a commodity that I have some of already and can get more, you know, maybe easier than other teams would because of where I tend to pick in the draft, I'd be open to it. It's just not something I'd be eager to do. And you know, I think this is always a tough line to straddle of, like, you know, the players who have the most value almost inherently are the players you should most want to keep. There are some exceptions due to like age window and considerations. Those do not apply to Filip Peronik. He's a 23-year-old. Like, it doesn't get younger than that, you know, in terms of like actual established NHL players. So if you're doing it, it has to be for something, to me, outstanding. I wouldn't do it for a run-of-the-mill first-round pick. I think you might. Is that fair?
Yeah. I think you're exactly right, or at least what you're saying is how I would think about it as well, where I wouldn't necessarily go chasing a deal because, again, a lot of that hinges on what Mo Sider is going to look like at the NHL level. You still haven't seen that. You've seen AHL, you've seen SHL, but, again, like I said, I think if you look at a lot of the different league equivalencies, the NHL is probably twice as difficult as both of those leagues. So yes, he's looked really good in those leagues, but that puts a lot of pressure on Mo Sider to be it. That puts a lot of pressure on future Brant Clark to be it. Right. That puts a lot of pressure on Troy Stetcher to be it. And so I don't know that I would necessarily chase that deal, at least now. I think if you bring Sider over and he has like a Cale Makar type impact, yes, I am absolutely chasing that deal. Because I want people to remember, hey, this guy was a first pairing defenseman. You want to give me a first round pick plus for him, because now I've got that. I'm all solidified. But at the same time, the trade off you're making is, how much better does Filip Peronik's performance get when you actually put him in a role that he's better suited for?
Right. You talk about Makar, like if first of all, Sider's not going to be Makar in terms of like the offense that Makar brings. It's a whole, that's an elite level. Like he's going to be on my Norris ballot. But if Sider's an immediate impact top pair defenseman when he comes over, why don't you want to just build a sick top four defense like Colorado so instantly did, that's so young now, between whether it's Makar, Girard, Byram's on the way, they traded for Devin Taves. Like, why not go that route with it? Just because you have Sider come over and hit, why not have two really good young right-handed defensemen?
So I think the challenge to doing that is going to be, how much do you pay Filip Peronik this offseason?
No doubt.
Because, you know, if that's what you ultimately think he is, that he's better slotted on that second pair as a 3/4, depending on what you've got, can you afford to pay that 3/4 $4 million, $5 million, $5.5 million. That's what I'm most curious about. And that's why I don't think he gets moved this summer. But what I'm most interested in seeing is what is he actually signed for? Because I think that'll tell you a lot about the perception here. Because, you know, if you take a look at Evolving Hockey's contract model, they actually have him projected on a bridge deal. They have him actually projected at $3.8 million for 2 years, which I think would be a pretty reasonable deal for a guy that you're interested in keeping. You end up making it a 5-year deal, and that projection flips to $5.5 million. So that's where I think it really depends on what they see in him and what they think he's going to be. But if you do get him at that 2-year, $3.8 million deal, I think you're better off hanging on to him, seeing what he looks like in that role, if you are going to go that longer route, then that's where I think you have to be looking to shop him, because you're not going to be able to win committing that much money to a player who's playing, you know, on your second pairing or your third pairing. Because if you look at the way the Avs did it, you know, Girard is their most expensive defenseman at $5 million. That'll change this offseason with Kyle Makar, but Devin Toews is $4.1 million. Ryan Graves is $3.1 million. So they were able to do it in ways that didn't require them to commit that much money to those bottom pairs.
I think that's fair. I mean, to me, I'm keeping Hronek, but I agree with your idea that you're not, you know, I'm not certainly not chasing a deal. I would have an open mind to something, especially if someone, like, on anyone, if someone wants to blow me away, I'm going to listen. Like, why wouldn't I? But, you know, if I'm a GM, I'm not looking to move out a guy who at 23 has proven he can play in any situation and has basically every trait that the Red Wings are going to want out of a defenseman anyway going forward at age 23. I think it's fair to look at the contract and say, is the role you're going to pay him for now reflective of the one he's going to play in later? But I think bridging does go a long way towards solving that, and you can kind of make that decision later down the road. So Hronek seems to be in some people's crosshairs right now, and you know that does happen in sports and in this sport. But to me, I still think he projects as a piece for this rebuild going forward.
Yeah, I think basically you can push this conversation off 2 years with a well thought out bridge deal. That's going to be key, and especially to get more data with him and Sider together, and not committing to something without knowing what Tuomi still looks like, without knowing who you draft in 2021. I think a 2 year deal makes a lot of sense because Filip Hronek is not a unrestricted free agent until after the 24-25 season. Correct. So you have time.
Yep. All right, on to some other young defensemen in the expansion draft. Phil Roberto wants to know, compare the performance of Lindstrom and Chulowski to the rest of the Red Wings' current defensemen. Why is it media, ourselves included, promoting a choice between them rather than keeping both? And I replied to Phil asking him a clarifying question, and I don't know, did he answer?
I did not see an answer from him.
All right. Come on, Phil. Help us out here. Well, nevertheless, I guess ultimately, I assume Phil's aware that the Red Wings can protect three defensemen in the expansion draft. So the reason that we've been framing it as Chulowski or Lindstrom is because I think you and I are on the same page that you're using two of those three spots on Hronek and on Stetcher. And so my question to Phil was, who would you expose in order to keep both, knowing you can only protect 3D? I certainly would not expose Hronek. He would be claimed in an instant. I think you would agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a no-brainer for Seattle to do.
I think Stetcher would get claimed, too. Seattle is an analytics-focused front office. Troy Stetcher, by analytics, I think is the Red Wings' highest-rated defenseman this season.
That is correct.
So he would get claimed as well. I'm not positive either Chulowski or Lindstrom gets claimed. I bet Chulowski does. I'm not positive Lindstrom does. But to me, I mean, I don't see a reason not to protect either of Hronek or Stetcher. So that only leaves Chulowski or one of the two for Chulowski or Lindstrom.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly where I'm at. Is like there's no way I cannot protect Troy Stetcher and Filip Hronek. I mean, if you're arguing not to protect Troy Stetcher, I think you've missed a lot of information from Stetcher this season because he's been very, very good, and he's still only 27. He just turned 27. This past month. So he is a guy that can be here for the next couple of years and still be a very serviceable defenseman. He gives you, again, that right shot. He gives you the skating that really he's the best skater, I think, on the Red Wings blue line. There's too many pieces there that I would just not be willing to part with, particularly when kind of the outcomes, the stats all line up with kind of the eyes. I just don't think you can leave him exposed, which means, yeah, you're picking between one of them. And then at this point, for Dennis Chulowski and Gustav Lindstrom, I mean, yes, they're both younger than Troy Stetcher. Do either of them have a ceiling that's higher than a third pairing defenseman right now? My answer is no.
Ceiling's a tough conversation because I think we have seen from Chulowski some of the skills that you would look for in a defenseman who is higher than the third pair. But having all the full information on Chulowski, do I think there's more than a 5% chance that he hits that kind of level? I don't. So, you know, I guess that's where we get into kind of realistic ceiling and the marbles. Like, how many marbles am I putting in the top pair jar at this point? Zero.
how many marbles am I putting in the second pair jar? Maybe one marble. And then the rest of the marbles are either in third pair or kind of 7th D territory. So I guess that's kind of, that's a tough way to frame seal. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think maybe a better question to ask yourself, and this is the question the Red Wings should ask themselves, is in the next 5 years, which defenseman's better? Troy Stetcher, Dennis Shalowski, or Gustav Lindstrom?
Yeah, and I think the answer is Troy Stetcher for me.
I think it's a slam dunk, Troy Stetcher. I mean, there's an outside probability. There's maybe a handful of scenarios, a 5% scenario, like you said, where Dennis Shalowski or Gustav Lindstrom is ultimately the best of those three. But I just don't see it right now.
Let's just get into the conversation then of Shalowski and Lindstrom, because we're already kind of dancing around it anyway. To me, what I see is Gustav Lindstrom, probably more the type of defenseman who fits what the Red Wings have done this year. I also think he's the easier replaced skill set of the two. And while Dennis Shalowski, I don't think fits quite the same way into the style and philosophy the Red Wings have wanted to play, in his skating and his shot and his passing, I do think he offers you some things that are harder to find or more expensive to bring in, at least, than Lindstrom. And that's why I would keep him on board and just see, you know, can you make it fit in the style you want to play? I would take more risk there, just because I think once you have a defenseman who has proven they can skate, they can score, they can, you know, produce offense, I just think that's more expensive and harder to find than the defenseman who can play a steady game and make a good first pass out of their own net. Not necessarily less valuable, but harder to get and more expensive once you do find it.
Yeah, I think that's actually a perfect summary. I think Lindstrom's skill set is embodied by this system, you know, steady defenseman that can make a good breakout pass, and that basically fits what he's doing here. And Shalowski, while he has a more diverse skill set, doesn't necessarily mesh as well with the system. To me, Lindstrom's the kind of guy that's a little bit more easier to replace within the confines of a system. And I'd hang on to the more rare skill set, like you said.
And, you know, you brought in a guy in John Merrill, who I think is the top end of what Gustav Lindstrom, of what you could want Gustav Lindstrom to be, right? Like, yeah. John Merrill's a dream outcome for Gustav Lindstrom. You got him for $1 million last year. I don't see why you can't bring him back for, you know, 2 years at $2.5 million this summer, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. Like, John Merrill is the best possible outcome here. And you're still, that best possible outcome was available for $1 million in free agency.
So, yeah. So to me, I think you have to protect Shalowski. I don't even know that Seattle's going to take Lindstrom if he's exposed. Like, he's not the kind of guy that typically in analytics circles, like, jumps off the page. Like, I got to get this guy. Maybe their traditional scouts really like him, or maybe they just see young right-handed D and that's enough to make it worth it. But I think if you protect Shalowski, expose Lindstrom, I think the odds are just as good that the Kraken could take Giovanni Smith or Evgeny Svechnikov than Gustav Lindstrom.
Yeah, I mean, I would be shocked if Lindstrom was taken. I mean, from an analytics standpoint, he doesn't, you know, grade out particularly well in the public models. And then even from a scouting standpoint, I mean, I think we sort of forget about this. He was a massive reach at the time of the draft relative to where he was placed. Bob McKenzie had him 85th on his list. Lindstrom went 38th. I think McKean's had him 103rd. ISS had him 159th. Central Scouting had him as the 25th best European player, and he went 38th. Like, it was just a huge pick, like, right out of the get-go to swing on him that high. And so I just wonder if it's one of those scenarios where the Wings thought they saw something there, and it just thus far hasn't panned out the way they were hoping it would.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
All right, on to the next category. You have anything else to say on that before we do it?
Nope, that's it.
Okay, this one's from Zygmunt K. Zygmunt, I was going to put this in my written mailbag, but since we're going to do it here, I'm going to take it out. But I guess the advantage is now you get Prashant's input, which is probably better than mine anyway. So Zygmunt asks, compare the Red Wings rebuild to other lottery teams. Who would you bet have the most or least success during the 2020s?
Oh, man, this is a lot of fun. I mean, If you're looking at the lottery teams right now, I guess, are we assuming that we're going as we stand here?
Does he mean lottery as in bottom 15 or as in like bottom five?
I'm going to maybe focus in on the teams that I think we can consciously say are rebuilding.
Right. Like,
because I don't think we can say Dallas, St. Louis, no. Philly, and Chicago certainly doesn't seem to be rebuilding. And Calgary doesn't really fit in that. Vancouver, even though they're in the bottom five, is not a team that is trying to rebuild, at least.
Yeah, they were in the playoffs last year. They actually won a round of the playoffs last year. I don't know if you can count them because they're kind of on the other side of their rebuild.
So maybe let's focus in on Buffalo, Anaheim, Los Angeles, Ottawa,
New Jersey.
New Jersey and Detroit.
Rangers exempt?
Yeah, I mean, the Rangers, to me...
they're post-rebuild. Okay,
how's their rebuild going? Well, you won two lotteries. Great.
Yeah. It started, you won two lotteries, signed Panarin, and it ended.
Yeah, I mean, they never really tore it down because as soon as they won that first lottery, they went out, right? They get Panarin, they get Trouba, you know, they add Kako, and then they win another lottery. And so, you know what? Rangers, I'm not even talking about you. So maybe if we focus on those seven teams, Buffalo, Anaheim, New Jersey, I guess Columbus technically falls in since they just started.
I think they should.
Columbus, Ottawa, Los Angeles, and Detroit. So, you know, if I'm at least stacking them up here, I think the team that's maybe in the best position is Los Angeles.
Yep.
I think they've drafted extraordinarily well. They're having a very competitive hockey team this year. I mean, just a little bit ago, we were talking about them potentially being in playoff contention. They've sort of slipped back a little bit recently, but I mean, they're a team that looks really good. They have a lot of great prospects. I mean, they've still got Quentin Byfield, who got to make his NHL debut. They've got Gabe Vilardi. I mean, they've got Arthur Kaliev. Just so many pieces over there. I'm probably forgetting some of the bigger names. Alex Turcotte, I think, is over there, right? So, I mean, the names go on and on and on. And Los Angeles is loaded. So I think if I'm betting on who's got the best outcomes in the 2020s, it's Los Angeles. But then after that, I think it's sort of a toss-up. New Jersey's got some better pieces than Detroit does right now. I mean, Jack Hughes obviously is a great piece. Nico Hischier is a great piece. And they've got some reasonable prospects there, and they're tearing down in a good manner. They're acquiring good draft picks. I wouldn't be shocked if they have some great outcomes. But I think Detroit's right there with them. Detroit's got a lot more picks, I think.
I like Ottawa in that tier, too.
Yeah. Ottawa, well, Ottawa ownership is the only reason I'm not going to put them there.
That's
because,
fair.
I mean, I don't know what they're going to do. Like, yeah, they drafted well. They got Brady Tkachuk. That's a good pick. And obviously, Thomas Chabot looks like a heck of a player. Eric Brännström, you know, maybe not as good as they thought he'd be, but still looks like a pretty solid player. Tim Stützle, you know, rookie adjustment this year. He'll be fine moving forward.
Batherson and Norris having good seasons.
Yeah, Batherson, right. Batherson's having an outstanding season. So, they've also got some young pieces there, but I think ownership is why I can't put them in that tier. So maybe if the way I'm looking at it, I think LA is your one. New Jersey and Detroit are in some fashion two or three. I think Ottawa and Columbus are maybe in that four and five. And then I'd probably go Anaheim and Buffalo after that.
That's interesting. So are you thinking Buffalo trades Eichel? Is that fueling some of this?
No, I'm actually thinking they don't. I think if they trade Eichel, that would push them up because in likelihood, right, they would actually get some nice first-round picks out of that, start from scratch and go from there. But hanging on to Eichel, I think, isn't going to fix anything here, and you're going to age him out eventually.
That's interesting. I think of it, if they keep Eichel, I would put him one, which I realize is crazy considering what their
betting
season
on
has
Buffalo
looked like this year.
All right.
I know, but they have to me like four of like the five things that you really, really want in your rebuild. And that is a true elite number one center. Check. That is Jack Eichel. You have the potential for an elite number one defenseman, Erasmus Dahlin. It hasn't been that way this season or last season when he was a rookie. He was awesome. And I still believe that the overall picture of Rasmus Dahlin would make me think if I have him on my team, I have my future number one defenseman in the organization already. You have a good farm system. You have guys who are at the NHL level or knocking on the NHL level, headlined by Dylan Cousins. He's the kind of prospect that I want coming up that I'm going to have on an ELC in the next couple of years to fuel this. You have a great kind of wingman for your star forward in Sam Reinhart. who's having, what, one of the better seasons of his career this year, right?
Yeah. I mean, Sam Reinhart's a good hockey player.
Now, the drawbacks that you see in Buffalo, Jeff Skinner's contract is a problem. I would want to see more depth on defense. I don't know if I'm buying the Rasmus Ristolainen show from this year or not. Obviously, like everyone, goaltending is going to be a big decider there. I didn't love the Jack Quinn pick last season necessarily, but I don't know a ton about Jack Quinn other than, you know, the goal totals that kind of came out of nowhere. Maybe he really pops and maybe I look stupid. You know, that it's totally possible. Wouldn't be the first time. Just check my bold predictions from this year. But, you know, to me, I just see they check a lot of boxes that you want, and they're the hardest boxes to check. And so, to me, I would take Buffalo's situation above most of those others, the salary cap being an issue. And obviously, the negative momentum in Buffalo is the other concerning thing. It's just like, I do feel like the more positive momentum you have, the better it is for the whole picture. Because then that's how you avoid situations like the one that Eichel is in right now, where we're talking about, are they going to trade this franchise center? I would go LA too, partly because of all those teams, they're the one that's in the best position to do something like trade for Jack Eichel. You know, like they could make a Jack Eichel trade happen in 2 weeks and they would have the pieces to do it, and it would not be a death blow to their rebuild by any means. So they could make a really compelling collection of picks and prospects to put together for Jack Eichel. And hey, you know, to your point, you could have good reason to think Buffalo would have to think about it. The one thing that gives me a little pause with LA is I'm not sold that their best players are their young guys. Like in terms of, you know, 3-4 years from now, even like, is Byfield going to be better than Kopitar? On draft day, I would have told you he's probably comparable kind of ceiling to Kopitar. And if he gets there, great. I'm not certainly passing judgment on Quinton Byfield off of this rookie season in the AHL at age 18. I think he's still going to be a stud, but If your like kind of best overall assets are still guys that are in their 30s, like Kopitar and Doughty are, it would give me a little bit of pause about accidentally getting dragged up into the middle and then not being able to kind of get out once those guys really age out of their prime. I do think they have enough depth to weather it. I think they're probably going to get their number one defenseman toward the top of this draft. The D certainly does stand out right now as an area that they don't have quite as much kind of prospect depth as they have up front. But you know, I think ultimately, even when Kopitar goes, if your 1-2-3 down the middle are like, you know, Kopitar, Turcotte, Vilardi, and you have Kaliev on the wing and you have Kempe on the wing, or you have Kempe at center and you flex one of those other guys to the wing, you're in a really good spot still. So I, you know, LA to me would be a clear two for me after Buffalo. With the caveat being, you know, you still want to see them add that franchise D piece, and you still want to know that all the important pieces are in kind of the under 30 at least range going forward. And then I would agree Detroit, New Jersey, and I would put Ottawa in that tier. And then I would put Anaheim behind that, and I would put Columbus behind that. Did I miss anybody?
No, I think you got them all.
Yeah, I would put Columbus in the worst spot. A lot of negative momentum from this year. Core pieces leaving rather than coming in. Not sure that they actually ended up getting a core piece in exchange for Dubois. Like, I don't know what happens with Line A now, but this season was not encouraging in that regard. Seth Jones is a free agent in a year. Zach Werenski's an RFA in a year.
Huh? Clean slate.
That's an advantage for sure. That they kind of the opposite of Buffalo in that regard. And maybe they'll get a stud. Maybe they'll win the lottery. Maybe they'll just get a great player in like 4 or 5 in this draft, or 1 in this draft. But, you know, I think they'd be last for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's reasonable. I think maybe the difference between you and I is I think you're looking more at like who's got the best pieces right now.
Yep.
And I think that favors your kind of rankings, whereas I think my rankings are mostly who's got the best coming
along and who's got the fewest obstacles.
Right, and who's got the fewest obstacles, which means there's no right answer here, because Max, you know, at the end of the day, you have to get those best pieces. And if you have them, well, that's a big check mark. You just have to be able to support those best pieces. Whereas in the other way around, sure, you've got all the flexibility and sure, you've got things coming, but they have to actually be good. So it's a interesting way to go about it. But yeah, I mean, it's a fun way to think about these teams that are rebuilding here.
Yeah, if you and I were going to prepare for a boat race against each other, I would buy a boat first and then go about fixing any of the issues with the boat. And you would save up looking and looking and looking to find the perfect boat. And you'd have less time, I guess, at that point before the race to, or you just have less certainty about what you're working with until you find the boat that you're going to get. But I would have the boat and be tinkering at it. And, you know, maybe you find a boat that has no structural issues, but I start out with the boat, I guess is how I would analogize that.
Yeah, I mean,
that.
You know, a boat's a boat, right? A boat could be anything. Right.
Yeah, that's
but,
right.
You know, I mean, I think that's a great way to put it. Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it is you went ahead and bought the boat. Now you're going to repair all the holes in it. Whereas I'm going to go, you know, try and find the pieces that make a boat.
It. Yeah,
and get it built, but I'm going to potentially run out of time here.
Yeah, exactly. All right, Adam Flett, how would you grade Sean Horkoff and the Red Wings development staff so far, and how would you measure their success? That's such a hard question. Is their role as important on developing draft picks as important as Blashill's? Hope you're both safe and well. Thanks, Adam, for the question. This is a very hard one. I mean, I think that second question is the key. How would you measure their success? I don't know the answer to that question.
I don't know. I mean, I've been trying to kick around how to measure development and how do you separate it from innate skill, and the reality is I don't think you can. Or if you can, I am not smart enough to figure that out. And so if you are that smart, please do figure it out and let me know so I can give a better answer here. But that's the key, right? You know, did the Wings at the time, you know, did they draft players that had the potential to succeed? And because of either the development team or some other obstacle, they didn't really get where they were supposed to be. I don't know what's to say here. All you can really say is that kind of the 17, 16, 15 drafts did not go the way the Red Wings needed them to go. And that's sort of why you're in this prolonged state. But I don't know who you pin that on, because, or if there's really even one singular entity that you could pin that on.
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't know how you could make that call. I mean, I do think you can look at things like, you know, you mentioned the 17 draft. You can look at like Michael Rasmussen and say, hey, here's a guy who maybe he doesn't have the ceiling of kind of the ninth overall pick that you thought when they made that pick. But also you can look at tangible ways Michael Rasmussen's really improved, including things like his skating in the last year, and say that, you know, that's kind of one of the things that I would point toward the development staff and say, like, that's what you're looking for your development staff to do, is help them fix certain traits. And that's one that I think, to me at least, that looks like it's obviously improved. But there's so much that we don't know. There's so much in, like, you know, in terms of like hitting the ceiling that is, you know, number one, we don't know how right we were about what the ceiling was on draft day. And number two, we don't know how to determine where that ceiling changed along the path. That it's just, you know, it's probably the hardest thing for us to assess this whole thing, right? It's right there with coaching, but it a lot of it comes down to the unknown, and it's just not something I feel like I can measure in a meaningful way.
Yeah, I mean, that's why when we talk about all these drafts, you know, the NFL draft, the NBA draft, MLB, and hockey, I think hockey and baseball are by far the two hardest to scout and to draft, because you're oftentimes working with less information from multiple leagues and having to adjust for so many things. It's just tough to even know if you had the right ceiling in the first place.
Yep, exactly. I think the development staffs are in a tough spot from that regard, because anyone who hits the draft, the drafters or the GM gets credit, and anyone who misses, it's why did the development staff mess this up? I think that's a really tough spot for them to be in.
Exactly.
Yep. All right, on to the next one. PJ Washer, looking at the last two or three drafts, how many players would you have taken instead of the Red Wings first round pick, i.e. someone picked after their selection? Hey, this dovetails nicely into a conversation we were having over text the other day about Moritz Seider.
I know. I mean, because in my usual need to rile up people on social media for my entertainment, I mean, I tweeted out a poll for the 19 draft. I'm going to go ahead and set aside the 2020 draft. It's way too early for me to say anything there.
I agree.
And no, I'm not taking anybody who went after Raymond above him, even though Jamie Drysdale's already in the NHL. I'm not doing that.
So. He's looked pretty good, hasn't he?
He has looked pretty good. But yeah. But I'm not taking anybody over Lucas Raymond just yet. So maybe the first one we'll focus on is 2019. And so, you know, I tweeted out a poll that asked, where would Moritz Seider go in a redraft based on the information you have right now? And shockingly, a majority of people said he would go in the 2 to 4 range. I actually think almost 50% of people who responded to the poll said he would go into the 2 to 4 range, which, for a reminder, the 2019 draft was Jack Hughes, Kaapo Kakko, Kirby Dach, Bowen Byram, Alex Turcotte, Moritz Seider at 6. I don't know that I could take him above maybe anybody at this point, except for Alex Turcotte is maybe the only one there. But then at the same time, you have to think about how good Dylan Cousins has been for Buffalo. I mean, Dylan Cousins is a bright spot in Buffalo. That's hard to do. You've got Spencer Knight making his NHL debut. You've obviously got Trevor Zegras has been dynamic and really, really excited. Cole Caulfield has made his NHL debut. So there's a lot of guys you have to think about. And then you also have to remember Nils Höglander went 40th overall. I think for me, if I'm redoing this redraft, I might be taking him at exactly 6 or even 7, depending where I'm going with potentially the one guy I would take that went behind him being Dylan Cousins.
Zegras?
I still don't know that I would take Zegras. I had, for full transparency, before that 19 draft, I had both Zegras and Cousins ahead of Sider.
Yeah.
And I think I was probably slamming text messages to you about taking Dylan Cousins on that day. And he's still the guy that I think is going to be the best center of the bunch between him, Doc, and Krebs being the other one there. And Peyton Krebs is also another guy who shouldn't have dropped as much as he did only because of his Achilles injury. But yeah, I mean, I think probably Dylan Cousins. I think Zegras has to be in the conversation there, and you could potentially slide Turcotte down, and that's how you get to 7. Otherwise, I think you're looking at one of those guys going above him, and maybe it's 6.
I had Zegras in that spot on draft day, and I agree with you that I would take Sider ahead of him today, although I still think Zegras obviously is going to score more points, but I think, you know, Sider, when you look at the whole picture, I think I'd probably go above Zegras. I would call it a toss-up with Cousins for me, and I think Byram is one where I think people are knocking Byram a little too much for not producing right now in the NHL. Sider's not producing right now in the NHL either. You know,
like, he has exactly Byram, 0 NHL points.
Exactly. Like, I think Byram would be producing in the SHL if he were there. So I'd still kind of, I guess, lean to Byram there. I would go somewhere probably 5 or 6 for Sider for me. It would still go Hughes, Kako, Doc in the top 3. And then Byram, if I'm saying kind of there's 3 in that Byram, Cousins, Sider tier for me, then I'm going to say you split the difference and put 1 ahead of him, 1 behind him. He goes 5th, but I could hear him at 6 behind both of them. If you could probably twist my arm to get him to 4, depending on if it was the day that he had like a 3-point game or something. But, you know, that's probably where I'm at.
Yeah, I mean, I think the strongest argument you can make for him is probably 5, and it's somewhere in reality is probably between 6 and 7.
I think that's fair. 5 to 7 is the overall range for me. So,
all right, I like it. All right, and then I guess the last one to cover out his question is the 2018 draft. So Wings took Filip Zadina at 6. A lot of people thought that was a steal. When Rasmus Dahlin, Andrei Svechnikov, Jesperi Kotkaniemi, Brady Tkachuk, Barrett Hayton, Zadina. And then, of course, it was Quinn Hughes, Adam Boqvist, Vitaly Kravtsov, Evan Bouchard. Max, you taking any of those guys ahead of Zadina at this point?
Well, Hughes, yeah. I don't think I'd take I wouldn't take Kravtsov, Boqvist, Bouchard. I don't think I'd take Wahlstrom.
Farabee?
Farabee would be tough. I think I'd probably still take Zadina, but you could have a good argument for Farabee. What do you think?
I think you could have a solid argument for Farabee. He certainly scored better than Zadina this far. I probably would lean Farabee over Zadina at this point.
It's a good argument. I mean, I think Farabee would be a top 10 pick for me in a redraft. The guys I'm interested in are the defensemen that went later. Keandre Miller, Rasmus Sandin, Nils Lundqvist. Any of those you're taking over Zadina?
I don't think so. I think part of it is I haven't seen enough of those guys to really be comfortable enough to part ways with Filip Zadina. I mean, Keandre Miller looks really, really solid in New York, but this is still his first season. And I have more information on Zadina, and I like the trajectory of Filip Zadina right now. So I'd probably still be sticking there. Lundqvist, again, a guy, very interesting.
Romanov would be another
seen
one.
Him. Yep, Romanov's another one. Sandin, I've only seen 35 games. I haven't seen enough to really sway me just yet.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, Zadina's still a top 10 pick for me. I don't know exactly where it falls. I'd certainly take him ahead of Hayton, who went ahead of him. Kotkaniemi, I think it's close. I don't know. What are you doing?
I'd probably take him over Kotkaniemi. Yeah,
I think so too. So, I mean, I think Zadina went right about the right spot. I think Sider went right about the right spot. So I think that's kind of ultimately what he's looking to ascertain there.
Yeah.
All right. Ramsenk. Curious where you guys stand with Jacob Vrana right now in regards to keeping him as part of the rebuild or trying to trade him for more assets. When they picked him up, I thought I was all about trading him, but dang, is he good and smooth. That's what Ramsenk says. Where are you at on Vrana?
Same place I was with Anthony Mantha. If the deal is as good as it is, you make the deal. Otherwise, you know, he's young enough to still be a part of things.
Yeah, I would say there is no rush. Like, there's no rush to get rid of this guy. You are a team that lacks offense, like few teams in the league, maybe no teams in the league do. This guy can give you offense at the snap of your fingers. He has proven that. He has done that in Detroit in just 9 games, 6 goals, 4 of them in 1 game. Beautiful shootout goal the other night. I would be keeping Jacob Vrána in the picture. I'm probably signing him with, you know, this offseason. Now, the question is, I mean, I'm definitely signing him this offseason. The question is, are you signing him with term or are you signing to a 1-year deal to get more information about him?
I honestly think you're giving almost the exact same deal you gave to Anthony Mantha. I think
that is what Evolving Hockey projects.
I mean, $5.5 million for 4 years is probably exactly what you do. I think in my mock rebuild, I gave him $5.4 million for 3 years, which is pretty close. So I think probably 3 to 4 years and somewhere in that ballpark.
Could you see an argument for going 1 year at 4.5 to just make sure that it fits and all that stuff before you do the longer deal?
I mean, you certainly could. I don't know how that would impact his price, I guess, like in terms of what his trade value looks like.
Yeah.
I'm trying to double check because, you know, the part of the benefit the Red Wings have this season is, or this offseason, I should say, is that he's still a restricted free agent. For them, 1 year still keeps him a restricted free agent.
Yes, it does.
Because his UFA year is until 2023. It does impact his arbitration rights. All that being said, I don't think it would significantly alter a future deal. So, yeah, I could see a 1-year show me deal being there as well. But I think he might be a little bit more valuable, like Mantha was at this year's deadline, with a little bit more term attached.
That could very well be. So, yeah, I mean, I would sign him, and then you're not going to hang up the phone on somebody who calls, but. You know, right now you're a team that lacks offense and he might be your best offensive player. Is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, he's by far the best offensive player on this team and it's not even close.
All right. Quick hitters, Josh Lodato, which prospects do you see being in GR next season?
That's a great question. I think it's probably going to be Albert Johansson, Lucas Raymond, Jonathan Berggren. Donovan Sobrango probably stays down there. McIsaac is probably still there. I don't think you see Tuomisto. I think he stays in the NCAA.
Sobrango has to go back to the OHL.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Sobrango will have to go back.
Which is so crazy. They should exempt anyone who got screwed by this year from that and already played in the AHL.
Yeah, that would be such a huge bummer for Sobrango. So, yeah, unfortunately, he would have to go back once the OHL season picks back up. But, yeah, I think that's probably the crux of who you're going to see there.
Any chance you think Johansson would stay one more in Sweden?
I don't think so. I think Johansson comes, but Vero stays. Vero's the other guy that I was thinking about.
Yep, I could see that. And I think Vero could be a candidate to get his ELC this summer.
Yeah, he's looking really, really good. He's a guy you probably want to advance a little bit quicker.
Yep, I would argue. So I think we're right in step there. I would put Raymond in GR. I think you would be a little more aggressive with him, right?
I would be a little more aggressive, but I think he ultimately ends up in GR.
Yep. All right, Ben Cozy, which UFAs will be back this offseason? So for a refresher, we're probably talking here about the pool of Gagne, Helm, Glendening, Ryan, Stahl. Who else? Is that it?
I think those are the...
Bernier.
Yeah, Bernier.
I guess Merrill we can include if we want to include guys who already left. Nemeth.
Yeah. I think that's it because everybody Redding's else legend, is a restricted free agent. Yeah. Yep. David Savard. No, I mean, if I'm picking guys who are UFAs to be back, I think the forwards I would consider would be Sam Gagne, maybe Bobby Ryan, if you're not going to go for a big splash. Goalie, I would absolutely bring Jonathan Bernier back. And then defense, I'm not bringing anybody back. Even John Merrill, I think I'm probably passing at this point.
I'd bring back Bernier, Merrill, in that order, 1-2. One of Gagne or Ryan. And then I think, you know, it wouldn't, I think Glendening makes sense to bring back, but I get why people say that they'd rather not. You know, I do think fourth line center is a position that you don't need to have, like, you know, a long-term, you know, guy who's been there forever doing it. I think it's not a bad place to be able to break in guys. But, you know, with skill guys, I think you want them, if possible, playing on higher roles. Like, I think if you asked Chase Pearson to handle the fourth line center role next season, he could do it.
You're setting up for a Chase Pearson reference. So.
Well, yeah, someone asked in the mailbag about him, so I'm already going to get that out of the way. But But yeah, you know, I think that, you know, Luke Glendening's a guy who makes perfect sense for what you're doing right now, but I don't think it's like a necessity. And I certainly think that it's a situation with any fourth line center, you're going with a short-term deal. So if you want to do a 1 year or 2 year, I don't see the downside of it. He's one of the better fourth line centers in the league, in my opinion. I don't know how that tracks with the underlings, but I don't know. I wouldn't have a problem bringing back three or four guys, but you know, Yzerman hasn't really done a lot of that since he's been here. Like, he's kind of been open to turnover. So it would not surprise me if it's just really two guys. Yeah, and I think, and to your point, Bernier Gagne would make a lot of sense for that.
That's kind of where I'm at, is Bernier Gagne. Although there is one other free agent we didn't talk about. It is a Henrik Zetterberg, whose contract will be coming up. I think that one's all done there.
Yeah, I don't know if he's going to be interested in re-signing.
I strongly doubt that.
He could be a good fourth line center.
I think he could still do it, yeah.
I got a question from my mailbag about why we were advocating for Gagne over Svechnikov. Do you want to touch on that really quick?
Yeah, I mean, so I think there's a couple of reasons. Number one, Sam Gagne is an incredibly talented player. He's 30 years old, has a lot of that skill that you like to see, has no problem playing the game that, or the style that Blasio wants, and has succeeded at it. So if you look at kind of the underlying statistics and goals above replacement, expected goals above replacement, he's been towards the top of the team for a majority of the season as one of Detroit's better players. He's kind of thrived in the system, and he did it for cheap. And, you know, he also seems to be a pretty good community guy with some of the fundraising stuff he's done around. So for me, he's a good locker room player to have. He's a good veteran. You know, you always talk about that veteran presence. That's what I see in him. And I think that can be valuable here.
I agree. He's the ideal, like, veteran player to have around, in that he actually is one of their more effective players on the team. And that, I know that doesn't always come up in goals and in assists, but in terms of, like, expected goals, in terms of winning his shifts and doing things the way they want to do them, he's very high on that list. And, oh, by the way, he's a really good guy who I think is the kind of guy you want setting the example for your young players. And it comes with that, you know, he's one of your more effective players, not just that's all he's there to do. I think that's important. I think you could say the same about Bobby Ryan, although Bobby Ryan's kind of more like he's going to get it done on the score sheet. He's maybe not the kind of complete game Sam Gagne has, but either one of them, I think, gives you that kind of effective veteran player. And I certainly, I'll tell you this, I wouldn't want them to go this offseason and bring back none of those three between Gagne, Glendening, and Ryan. I think you got to bring back at least one of them. I would probably bring back two of them, but I can hear an argument that it should be one of them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I'd bring back one of them as well. And that's why Sam Gagne is kind of the one that I think still contributes the most of them and can maybe still provide that veteran presence.
Actually, so Phil from that Stetcher question finally just replied on Twitter and said, expose 70. He's got 1 year left. If they decide to keep him as trade bait, they'll get a fourth, all for the risk of losing a young player with potential to be much better than that pick. Same for Namestnikov. Why protect placeholders? So I guess we can add a little bit of context to that, although I do think we basically covered this. I just think, you know, viewing a 27-year-old as a quote-unquote placeholder, I don't know if that's really an accurate reflection of what's going on here. Like, I don't know why Stetcher is more of a quote-unquote placeholder than Lindstrom would be.
And, I mean, viewing a 25-year-old as a prospect with a lot of potential is also the same thing. I mean, there's certainly the potential for me to go out and score 30 in my next game, but you know what? It's a low probability. You know, and so calling Svechnikov a guy with a lot of prospects, a prospect with high potential isn't really a thing, because he's going to be 25 in 5 months. You know, you same thing for Chalowski and Lindstrom. They're 23 and 22 respectively now. Like, it's not that they're getting old in that sense. It's that they're sort of aging out of the time frame where we are going
to expect, there's much more projection left.
Yeah. Right, where we are going to expect radical changes to happen to their game. They are who we thought they were. Like, give me the Denny Green reference right now. They are who we thought they were. Like, that's what it is at this point. Like, you're running out of time to see more from them. So I'd rather take the player who's better right now.
The 1 year deal thing wouldn't concern me, because you can just re-sign them. Like, you're not at the point where, you know, they're going to price themselves out of, you know, of anything. I mean, I think the only case you have is, you know, if Chalowski or Lindstrom are good, like, you can give them the room to prove it, I guess. But right now on the defense, I don't see that being a problem. If they believe in these guys, they want to see these guys, they can already do that regardless of what happens with Stetcher. So
I don't see a case to protect either of them over Stetcher. I think you are deciding between one of the two. And I don't think it's accurate to call either Stetcher or Namestnikov a quote-unquote placeholder. I just don't believe that at all.
Yeah, I think it's, again, it's selective bias in the sense of viewing
all of pro sports, like there's turnover. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
All right, that's going to do it for us today. We'll be back at you later this week. No games in between now and then, so you know, good luck to us coming up with some topics. And if you guys have any suggestions, mboltman@theathletic.com, or you can get either of us on Twitter. Thanks so much and take care.